Winning said, Aslan doesn't really have a low opinion of Jill. Jill has a low opinion of Jill, whether she admits it or not, and she molds her perception of Aslan and his intentions to fit that mold.
I like that.
Welcome to Talking Beast, the Narnia Web Podcast. This is Patter Twig's pal.
And this is Melton Tall. I will be your host today since Glumpuddle is away.
He gave us free rein to discuss whatever we would like, so we figured after comparing Silver Chair to superhero movies that we should give Jane Austen her time as well.
I mean, you know, is Silver Chair a superhero story, or is it more, you know, an old-fashioned comedy of manners?
That's a good question.
I thought so.
So there is, before we get too far into this, a connection between Lewis and Jane Austen. He enjoyed reading her books. He mentions her frequently in his letters. And
he actually wrote an essay on the phrase, I dare say, which you'll notice shows up frequently in his own works. But in the essay, he mentions that Jane Austen used it in a transitional fashion between the old usage and the newer, more modern, lighthearted, and frivolous use, which is what shows up in his own works.
Shall we go to one of those works now and discuss chapter 2 of Silver Chair?
I think we should.
The first question is, when the lion first sees Jill, he turns away as if he knew her quite well and didn't think much of her. Why does the lion seem to have a low opinion of Jill?
Well, I think the question is actually, is this the lion's opinion of Jill, or is it Jill's opinion of what the lion's opinion is?
Yes, that point did come up in the reading group too. It's back to the, is this the narrator's opinion, or is the narrator merely reflecting Jill's opinion?
I mean, the narrator in Silver Chair is focused on Jill, so we find out more of what Jill is thinking than any of the other characters. So that would be one point toward it being Jill's actual opinion as opposed to the lion's.
I'm tending to see the narrator as more objective, whether or not that's the case, because the narrator definitely has such a active role. We get little asides throughout about things like that. But maybe we should look and see what the long quote is. Because I think it gives a little bit more information, if I remember correctly.
Well, it's one of those, how much can you figure out about what a lion is thinking when you're only looking at it?
Exactly. Though a lion like Aslan does use his, he would have expressions, he can talk.
But Jill didn't know it at that point.
True. Let's see. It lay with its head raised and its two forepaws out in front of it, like the lions in Trafalgar Square. She knew at once that it had seen her, for its eyes looked straight into hers for a moment, and then turned away as if it knew her quite well and didn't think much of her. So, we know that the lion sees her. And then part of that same sentence is that it turned away and as if it knew her quite well and didn't think much of her, which we could see as, I think it could be interpreted either way.
Well, it's one of those, you think about your own cat, every so often your cat will just look at you and go, eh, human.
Yes. And I think, I mean, the lion did have plenty of reasons to not have a good opinion of Jill. She did, after all, just cause Eustace to fall off of the cliff.
This is true. And then she ran away because she was frightened not only of, you know, what she had done, but also of the lion who was fixing her mistake.
And with this, then, if we go to the forum, the Rose Tree Dryad says, it could be that he is simply upset that she has messed up his plans after her behavior at the cliff. Or it could be a kind of reverse psychology, trying to draw her near by seeming disinterested or unimpressed. The impression I've always gotten from that particular line, however, is that Jill, at the beginning of The Silver Chair, is somewhat self-absorbed and a cowardly person.
Yeah, I guess I don't think I've ever really gone so far as to go, oh, I think Jill's a coward, but I mean, I think she's more relatable as in, oh, gee, if I was in that sort of situation, what would I be doing? Probably not running out to make things right.
Wagga had an interesting point about why the lion might have a low opinion. Perhaps Aslan also disapproves of people who show off at other people's expense, who do not use simple common sense about safety, and who don't take sufficient responsibility for their own actions to avoid hurting others. Okay, that means a whole heap of people. I don't think the lion would approve of me either. You know, and when I was looking at this question at first, it's like, well, Aslan's supposed to be a Jesus figure. So, and Jesus is, you know, would Jesus look at a child like that? And the more I got to thinking about it, maybe he would if the child was behaving in such a way. I mean, he, with his own followers, he was not always, he would correct them when they were wrong. One minute he's telling Peter, good job. The next minute he's telling him, get behind me, Satan. And then that got me thinking about, well, we know that Aslan is not, strictly speaking, Jesus. It's just a supposition and everything. It seems very, very harsh, but I guess at this point, Jill has not confessed her sin. She is not coming towards him. So yeah, he probably would have a rather low opinion of her.
And he's waiting to see what she's going to do next.
It was interesting. No, if we go with the theory that it's not the lion that has a low opinion of Jill. Winning says Aslan doesn't really have a low opinion of Jill. Jill has a low opinion of Jill, whether she admits it or not, and she molds her perception of Aslan and his intentions to fit that mold.
I like that. That does seem like a very, very logical conclusion to come to, and that really is how a lot of us think about it. Ourselves and other, mm-hmm. We're not nearly quite as objective as we'd like to think we are.
Exactly.
The conversation between Jill and the lion then is pretty interesting.
You gotta kind of feel bad for Jill though. Here she is in a strange country all by herself, which is her own fault. But I think we as Narnia fans are awfully hard on Jill. I mean, she knows that animals can talk, but she has no reason for knowing specifically this lion does talk. Eustace did not tell her a thing about what Aslan was. So you can't really blame her for being terrified of the lion and worrying about being eaten. She has no context whatsoever for dealing with him. When you think about the other books, they have all at least heard about Aslan and that he's a lion before they meet him. The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, and the Voyage of the Dawn Treader specifically.
I mean, even Shasta, who doesn't, know that he's meeting Aslan, is aware that there is an Aslan who takes the form of a lion.
Yes.
Although, I mean, he's been worried about lions the whole book, so maybe that's not exactly the best analogy, but...
So let's go on to question 4. Why doesn't the lion promise not to eat Jill?
Because that's not the promise she needs to hear at the moment. I don't know if I can elaborate on that much further. I mean, she's worried about physical danger. And his answer is more like, well, that's not what I'm here for.
Yeah, that makes sense. So he's trying, I wonder if he's trying to give her a crash course in his nature.
Yeah.
Because if we look at the whole conversation, first he speaks.
And it's like, talking lion.
Talking lion. Okay. Got that. And then, what he says, it isn't like, come here so I can eat you. He doesn't jump at her right away to eat her. I mean, she probably wasn't thinking logically, but she's been standing there for who knows how long.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't make any moves to eat her. There's no way she could escape by running. She pretty much knows that.
Mm-hmm.
She knows the lion knows she's there, but yet she's still worried about being eaten. Mm. I would assume that
maybe she's worried about, you know, trespassing on invisible boundaries. And it's like, if I go too close, then he'll, you know.
Yeah.
Then he can reach me. And then it's not, you know, extra effort. It's like, oh, look, the food came to me.
Yes, that very well could be.
So, yeah, so you're, so he's pointing out that he's not just a normal lion with animal instincts. He's pointing out that he's a reasonable being with other concerns. And, you know, eating people is, sure, it's a thing he does, but it's not why he's there.
The first thing he says, if you're thirsty, you may drink. So he's giving her permission to drink. That's what she wants most in the world. However, at first she doesn't even know who was talking to her. And then, you know, he kind of prods her. And then, she just asks him if he wouldn't mind moving while she drinks, which doesn't work out at all for her.
She does ask.
She does ask. She doesn't even say please, though. But I do love how she realizes that she might as well have asked the whole mountain to move aside for her convenience. If you think about that, then she's learning that she should have already known this, but in weighing those two characters, the lion is much more important, powerful than her. You know,
she's the newcomer. He's already there. He knows. Yes.
She has no influence whatsoever over what he will or will not do. And that probably also goes back to the, will you promise not to do anything to me if I do come? And he's like, I make no promises. It's not his, I mean, if he wants to promise her something, he can, but it's not why he's there. Raidian says that she gets the sense the lion is testing Jill's courage and resolve with a lot of his choices not to lay things out in front of her and make it easy. In a strange way, this might also be about building trust. The lion has no reason to eat Jill, and she has no choice but to put her life in his paws by drawing near to him to drink. And then also, the Luke Skywalker 2 also says it kind of involves trust. Jill needs to trust Aslan and his signs, otherwise the mission would likely go uncompleted. I mean, I can kind of see where they're coming from, and yes, she does kind of have to trust him, but she also doesn't, when she steps forward to drink, she has no idea whether or not he's going to eat her. She just has to go after what she needs.
Which at the moment is the drink, and then she has to trust that it's going to refresh her?
It's just something that she has to do. At this point, she has no reason to understand why she should trust the lion. She doesn't know who he is. You know, and I would say, assuming you knew nothing about Aslan, save the name,
mm-hmm.
and unless you were a scholar and knew Turkish, you would have no reason to suspect that you were going to be meeting a lion.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, is where we need, you know, we don't always think about it as like, yeah, of course she's got to trust him. He's Aslan. He's important.
But on the other hand, Jill is coming into this and she has no clue. And so she is trying to make light of it in her previous experiences. So how do you think that's going to play out in the movie? I mean, are most people going to approach this as, oh, it's a lion, it must be Aslan, or are they going to go, oh no, this kid is just walking up to a lion. This is terrible. This is not sensible. This is...
I would imagine that the trailers are going to feature Aslan in some respect, so that makes it hard. It'd be nice if they could kind of like keep that back and let the audience feel what Jill feels. You know, there's this lion. She's thirsty. What is she going to do?
In some of those, but it's Narnia, and so they're automatically going to look at it and go, a lion equals Aslan, even with a new character design.
Yes. So I don't think the audience will be able to feel that, because we don't necessarily maybe want to advertise it without Aslan.
Well, I definitely don't want to advertise it without Aslan. I mean, Aslan is minimizing Aslan's influence on the story is to take him out as a character and keep him only as the magician at the end who makes everything happen, give everybody their happily ever after.
And yes. You know, and that kind of brings us to how do we want Aslan to be portrayed in this movie and in all of them. And Glumpuddle wrote in the forum, each Narnia book reveals something surprising and new about Aslan. So what do we learn new about Aslan in this scene? And is that important for the movie?
You know, considering how little Aslan is actually in this one. I mean, basically he shows up at the beginning and then he bookends it at the end. And so you're not actually going to have other instances of... So you're not going to have concrete instances of his presence. You're just going to have, oh, she remembered the sign at the right time. She had a dream. She...
Yeah, so it's largely...
It's felt, but not seen, which yes. is hard to translate to a visual medium.
There's definitely the dream sequence where... Aslan will need to appear. But I think the first three movies all miss the boat on Aslan and who Aslan is. Because if going with the theory that we learn something in each Narnia book about who Aslan is, you know, in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, we're introduced to him. And in the movie, it was more about the kids than Aslan.
Because in the movie he was, well, even in the book, he was already there. He was, he had prepared an army, and so it's portrayed as the kids are coming in and they're like his understudies in the movie. Whereas in the book, I'm not sure that that's the sense you get.
No, the sense you get is that Aslan came and spring is coming because Aslan came. And we need to go to Aslan because he will be able to rescue Edmund to fix the mess that you got into.
And incidentally, you're going to be kings and queens for years and years and years. Whereas, would you say in the movie there's more of a emphasis on, oh, you came to Narnia, you're going to be kings and queens?
Yeah, it's more, oh, we really, really need you.
Yes, you know, as opposed to, oh, hey, there's a prophecy that says there's four thrones to be filled by four kids.
And, you know, in the movie, it's like, oh, we have to go to Stone Table because Aslan's gathering your army. Now, it does end up being Peter's army, but... I always thought that more of the sense that
it was Narnia's army.
Narnia's army, and they were coming because Aslan was there and he was going to help
them overthrow the witch.
You know, and I think there's a risk to think of Aslan kind of as this grandfatherly type lion that like comes in, gives encouraging speeches, and actually, a lot of times, there's a little bit of that in the churches with Jesus, like, and God, and like, oh, you are accepted. Jesus loves you.
They focus too much on the love and not enough on the, he's God. He created the world. He's pretty awesome.
There are consequences for your action. Yes, you are forgiven, but you still need to repent and work on trying to be like him and, you know, learn from
your mistakes
and learn from him. And, you know, yes, he lets us do his work and he makes work for us to do, but ultimately it's Jesus. Whereas in the Narnia books, ultimately, you know, like, it's Aslan who's behind the scenes guiding things. and I was thinking, you know, I think a lot of Aslan's role is, I mean, he's doing the overseeing, but he's there to teach the children.
Yeah, because there's the phrase in Voyage of the Dawn Treader where you must learn, know me by another name there.
And, you know, we remember the scenes where, you know, Lucy and Susan, they romp with Aslan. They get to play with him, you know. But then both of them also see the stern side of Aslan. And they even mention, you know, like Lucy sees him the most. And we know that there's like that special bond between Aslan and Lucy. Mm-hmm. But some of the stuff he asks her to do, he's not easy on her either.
No.
I mean, he
rebukes her in Prince Caspian.
And in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And she's given the task to go and wake up her brothers and sisters in Prince Caspian. That is by no means a job that she wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's, you know, where Aslan comes in. I mean, sure, he can be tender, he can be sweet, but he's also very stern, and he makes the characters face what they've done.
Mm-hmm.
And that we see that with Jill when he says, well, what happened on the cliff? He makes her go through all of that and get to the point where she confesses what she has done.
Yeah, similarly with Peter and Edmund, and Peter's like, oh, I think it might have been my fault that Edmund is, you know, acting out and looking for ways to prove that he's just as much of a, you know, I don't want to say a macho hero, but I mean, he wants to prove that he's worthy of his big brother, or, you know, better than his big brother. And so, hey, I'll be king and you'll be a duke. Ha! That'll show you.
Yes. Well, we're talking about Aslan's character. I think definitely he's been watered down way too much in the movies. So what do you think? Has he literally eaten realms, kingdoms, boys, girls? I didn't say that line the right way, but yeah. You get the idea.
Well, it's one of those, he can sing realms into existence. So, you know, who's to say that he can't, you know, eat them out of existence? I've always taken that as a, yeah, there was probably some pretty exciting stuff going on somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, I've always
not seen necessarily in Narnia, but, you know, some world where Aslan has influence. Ooh.
Yeah, I mean, and he could. I always assumed it was literal. You know, he just said it. And it's probably very similar to when justice is raised. You know, in the Bible, there are some not so, you know, like whole towns and things were destroyed.
Tents were swallowed up in an earthquake. It's one of those, if you're going for biblical allusions, yeah, sure. Aslan absolutely could have meted out justice in that way.
And if we go forward to the last battle, doesn't his shadow swallows up?
Yeah.
The people who
they stream into the shadow and they're gone. It's a very, very stark image.
So the Rose Tree Dryad said to this one, at first I was going to say no, because I can't imagine Aslanzilla having a city for breakfast. And I don't really see the utility of that either. But then I thought about how in the last battle, Father Time takes the sun in his fist and squeezes it like an orange. In general, Narnia is a place where things that are only seen as metaphor in our world are actually true. So I suppose I'll fall on the literal side here. Even if it isn't literal, though, I don't think it means less. Just like how God stretching out his hand to strike Egypt in Exodus doesn't mean less, because Egypt isn't actually being laid to waste by a giant hand. These are hard words for the reader to swallow, regardless of what Aslan means by them precisely. And Glumpud also says, I take it literally simply because I can't think of a great reason not to.
Some of those, well, yeah, I mean, you'd have no reason not to trust the narrator. You have no reason not to trust the characters. So, yeah, of course it's literal.
It's a lion. Lions eat things. It's Aslan. I mean, we don't know that at the time, But I mean, he could be telling Jill, yeah, I'm capable of this. Are you going to drink or not?
Yeah.
And we see this that Aslan's not someone you want to mess with. He's in control.
The picture he's drawing is not necessarily one of Aslan Zilla, where he's just, you know, rampaging through the town right and left. It's a very deliberate sort of action.
Yes. I mean, he doesn't say it like, sorry, boasting. He just says it. It's like, yeah, I've done that. And probably the undertone is it needed to be done. And if you take the stuff in Prince Caspian, you know, he turns somebody who's beating a kid into a tree. He may or may not have turned schoolboys into pigs. He's not a tame lion. And that in this line, that really comes through. So Jill is getting the harsher, the strong, in control, I'm God side of Aslan first. And then she gets the side that corrects her. Like, what were you doing? Why did this happen? And then, you know.
She's getting the side that's been watered down in the movies to date. If cross your fingers that they're not going to substantially change the point of the scene, it is going to be very different look at Aslan than anything we've seen to date.
Yes. And I think it needs to be. We need to see that Aslan is just not a big kitten.
Yeah. Big fluffy lion that
can come in and destroy enemies, but
he's perfectly safe for you. He's a lion.
He's not safe in multiple ways. I mean, just by having dealings with Aslan, Jill's going to be sent on a journey, on a quest. That's not going to be easy. It's not going to be safe.
There are no saves, undos, or restores to last save point. So if you mess up, you have to...
Yeah, deal with it or die in the attempt.
Just like all the other people who went off looking for the prince.
But So Aslan starts out quite stern, tough with her, but he does show the gentle side. He's very, he takes the time needed to teach her, and
he's not threatening. He just is.
Yes, he just is, and that's he doesn't say one way or the other, and it's probably none of her business whether or not. it is her. She doesn't want to get eaten. But he doesn't owe her an explanation. She owes him one.
Yeah.
Even though she doesn't
know it.
But she's got a sense some of that, because once he talks, she switches how she's afraid of him.
Mm-hmm. Which makes sense. I mean, yes. You go from
the lion's voice did not make Jill any less frightened than she had been before, but made her frightened in rather a different way. So she's still...
I mean, she's switched from a fear of being of wild animals to maybe fear of authority.
Yes.
Because clearly he belongs in this land and she's doesn't.
I mean, and she's still afraid of being eaten. But I think she's also sensing some of that, oh my, he's not just a lion. He can talk. He's sensing some of his majesty, his... power that she didn't get until she realized that he could talk. And that's what I really hope comes through, is that we see Aslan as the stern, the powerful side of Aslan. I have eaten people and realms and kingdoms. But then we also see I have called you into Narnia, and this is what you will do, but I'm going to be gentle with you and teach it to you. And I think it goes back to the reason that Aslan says in The Voyage of Don Treader, they are brought into Narnia so that by knowing me
here you can might know me better
there. He's brought them there to teach them lessons. And sometimes, teachers need to be stern. Sometimes they can be kind and gentle, but you cannot forget that in this case, this teacher is also the god figure of the book, the all-powerful and the one who's in charge. And he's going to let you make your own mistakes, but in the end, he will not let you stray from the mission. Is there anything else that you'd like to bring up about this chapter?
Nope. I think we covered it.
All right. Then you know what time it is.
Oh, no. Not that time.
Yes, it is time to stump a Narnia Weber.
Oh, after... Really? You want to try and stump me again after my performance last time?
Well, see, it's either... me stumping you or you stumping me, so I think I'll stump you.
Okay.
I will try to be somewhat kind.
Oh, okay.
All right. At the end of the silver chair, a centaur comes to look at Puddle Glum's foot. What is the centaur's name?
What is the centaur's name?
And if you need to, you can sound Queen Susan's horn. I can try to give you multiple choice, or you can look it up in the book.
Let's see. I always like multiple choice.
Do you want multiple
choice? Yes, I will then blow Queen Susan's horn and go for multiple choice.
All right. Option A is Glenstorm. Option B is Runewit. Option C, Cloudbirth.
Well, let's see. So it's clearly not Glenstorm, because Glenstorm is in Prince Caspian. And although, you know, centaur names might be passed down through families and so on, it's probably not Glenstorm. I know Runewit is a Narnian centaur. If you'd asked me, I would have said he showed up in Last Battle. And Cloudbirth does not sound like a Narnian name. Let's see. So I got 30 seconds to choose between B and C. How confident am I that Runewit is in Last Battle? Pretty confident, so I'm gonna go with C. How's my test taking skills?
Good, you are correct.
Yes! So he's Cloudbirth.
Yes.
Oh. I did not remember that at all. I remembered the centaurs having, you know, double breakfast because, you know, they had to feed the horse part and the man part, but.
Yep, and those centaurs apparently don't have names.
Oh, okay, well, that would be why. I don't remember them being named. Well, they weren't named. Okay. So we had multiple centaurs. Okay.
Yep, we did. All right. So until next time,
further
up and further in.